Malthorn security personnel, Tolvern continued. The slavers only needed enough force to stop raids, to deter smugglers, to put down sugar riots. More about intimidation and security than fighting real enemies. They never expected a war, that's for sure.
Then it was careless, he said. It will cost them.
Anyway, this base was more or less mothballed until recently. Look, you can see they've been burning back the vegetation.
How many men are inside? He asked.
That was a good question. The enemy had assembled a formidable force in preparation to put down the sugar revolt, but most of those men had recently departed to fight Pez Rickon's attempt to cut the road. That didn't mean it was abandoned. She could see the guard at the machine gun nest. The tower was no doubt manned, too.
Just get us inside, Tolvern said. We'll worry about the rest then.
Carvalho nodded.
I will take out the machine gun nest first. As soon as you give the signal, it is gone.
Good. Then hit that guard tower. Knock it out if you can. Draw its fire if you can't.
Oh, I will take care of it, don't worry. You keep yourself safe.
Right.
She prepared to climb down to where Nib Pym and the others waited.
I'll send Brockett up to help you load ammo. Best use for him, I figure, rather than running around getting shot at.
I mean it, Carvalho said. You be careful now, you understand? I would not want to see you die.
You're not getting all sentimental on me now, are you?
Somehow he managed to shrug both his shoulders and his mouth at the same time, in what was a very Ladino expression.
Perhaps a little bit.
Tolvern poised on the edge, with a hand wrapped around a vine and a leg dangling over the side.
Cap might be good with what happened last night, but I doubt she'd be too keen on anything she'd call feelings. So we're professionals now, right? We know what needs doing, and we'll do it.
Got it.
He scowled and turned to fiddling with the gun. It was the first time they'd mentioned what had passed between them in the hammock. She didn't regret it, assuming she, Carvalho, and Cap herself were right about all the parties involved, but neither did she plan to make a habit of it, and she was sure Carvalho didn't either, if he gave it 2 seconds of thought. Once Tolvern reached the ground, she gave Nib Pym final instructions, which he translated for the others. Counting Blackbeard's pilot, she had 17 Hrum in her force. They came to the edge of the trees, about 100 yards outside the gates to the base. Any natural camouflage the Hrum enjoyed among the red and purple jungle of the lowlands was negated here in the higher elevations, where Terran vegetation had taken root, with all its shades of green. But a deep ditch flanked the dirt road to drain off the heavy rains, and the enemy had not yet cleared it. Tolvern led the others into waist-high weeds and brush, and then had them fan out down the ditch, moving on their bellies. Tolvern looked at her computer to get the time.
5 minutes, she told Nib Pym. Then you go, whether I give you the signal or not.
Nib Pym checked his own computer and gave a human-style nod. Tolvern continued, along with 3 Hrum, leaving Nib Pym and the rest behind. They crept along the ditch toward the base. Only in the last 50 feet had someone bothered to burn down the vegetation, and it was here that Tolvern stopped. She looked at her computer. 4 minutes and 50 seconds already, she'd cut it close. She touched her ear to activate the comlink.
You ready, boys?
Nib Pym and Carvalho answered in the affirmative.
All right then, go!
Tolvern flattened herself. The Hrum behind her let loose seconds later. Nearly a dozen rifles targeted the machine gun nest and the guard tower. A split second later came the heavier thump, thump, thump of Carvalho's machine gun in the tree.
Got him,
he said over the comm. She lifted her head. The gun barrel behind the sandbags tilted skyward. Now tracer bullets from Carvalho's gun slammed into the tower itself.
Going in, she told Nib Pym. Don't shoot me in the back.
The assault rifles behind her fell silent. She jumped up with an encouraging shout and ran toward the still open gates. Her 3 Hrum companions followed. A quick glance behind showed other Hrum pouring on the road from the ditch. The human in the sandbag bunker slumped over the back end of his gun, which had sent the barrel skyward. Large caliber bullets riddled his body. Never stood a chance, poor bugger. So far, not a single response from the enemy base. Carvalho had taken out the machine gun in the first moments and now kept hitting the guard tower. He didn't have unlimited bullets. It was no mean feat to haul those ammo cans dozens of miles through the brush, but this was no time to conserve. Take the base, and they'd get their hands on everything they needed. Tolvern and her three companions burst through the open gates. The base was several hundred yards wide, with two long barracks on the right side, a control tower with an empty helipad in the center, and to the left, a pair of hangars, flanked by the same sort of windowless concrete dormitories that housed slaves on the plantations. Three pale-skinned Hrum ducked their heads and ran across the open space between the two barracks. One of the rebel Hrum fighters lifted her gun, but Tolvern ordered her to stand down. They weren't going to shoot unarmed base workers, especially not when they had so many other objectives. First, the guard post. An external metal staircase climbed to the top of the post in a series of switchbacks comprising three separate landings. Several other Hrum from the ditch were now entering the base, and here they met their first resistance. A small lorry with oversized mud tires rolled from one of the hangars. Two men stood in the back, leaned over the cab, and fired. Rebel Hrum threw themselves to the ground and returned fire. Tolvern left this fight to others and moved quickly to secure the metal staircase. She got on the comlink to Carvalho.
"I'm coming up. Hold your fire."
The gunfire halted from outside the base. She positioned two of the Hrum at the first landing while she continued up with her last fighter. She tried the heavy metal door at the top. Locked. So much for the hope that the enemy had continued their series of defensive blunders. She removed a grenade with a timed charge, set the timer for 10 seconds, and activated it. Then she and her companion ran down to the next landing, crouched with covered ears, and braced themselves. Bullets pinged off the metal railing near her head. Then came the explosion. It shook the landing until Tolvern thought she'd miscalculated, and the entire building would collapse, staircase and all. But when the shaking stopped, it was still standing. Only the door was damaged. It had blown inward and lay smoking on the floor inside the guard tower. She grabbed her companion, and they charged up. Maybe the guards were dead, maybe not. But she wouldn't take chances. They came in, guns firing. At nothing, it turned out. All of Carvalho's shooting, after taking out the sandbagged gun below, had been wasted. There was nobody manning the guard post. Someone had slept in, ventured off with the security forces, or taken their coffee break without leaving a replacement. There was a heavy machine gun mounted on the exterior wall, together with several ammo cans. Tolvern and her companion dismounted the gun and shifted it to a loophole on the inner wall of the tower. The Hrum dragged over ammo cans from the corner, and Tolvern pulled back the bolt and aimed the gun toward the interior of the base. The small lorry and its men had kept the rebels pinned near the entrance. Some of her fighters had taken refuge behind a small shed, while two others lay sprawled and motionless in the dirt, their weapons fallen, gunned down by the enemy. Other rebels had been unable to enter at all. Meanwhile, several humans deeper in the base seemed to be organizing a defense of humans and their Hrum slaves, using the lorry as a shield. Tolvern aimed at the lorry and let loose. The gunner went first, and then she tore up the engine block, shredded the tires, and battered down the windshield. She swept the gun to the left and right until she'd cut down or scattered all the defenders. Their way now clear, the rest of the rebels entered the base. Tolvern stayed at the gun until Carvalho and Brockett entered a few minutes later, hefting the machine gun and ammo. After they had it set up on a tripod, Tolvern left her companion in the guard tower and went down to join them. They now had three working machine guns, including the one captured outside the gates. The gun at the guard tower kept them covered as Tolvern and Carvalho moved toward the center of the base, tossing grenades and firing at anything that moved. It took less than an hour to overrun the entire base. The attack left 15 dead enemies, captured 40 prisoners, and sent another 20 or 30 humans and Hrum fleeing in lorries down the road on the opposite side of the base. Tolvern lost 4 Hrum from her own force, with 3 others suffering light wounds. Carvalho had pinned down the last 2 surviving enemies and was still trying to force a surrender when Tolvern called Pez Rickon.
"We've got the base," she told him. "Not as much gear here as I thought. But we're still turning over rocks looking for it all. But we've got maybe 100 more guns and plenty of ammo. Some new heavy weapons, too. Captured 2 lorries, but they're shot up and in need of repair. Are you still pinned down?
No, the fight is already over. We were forced to withdraw.
What? How many did you lose?
Several dozen. Perhaps 100.
Her stomach sank.
I told you not to fight. I told you to pin them down as long as you could and get out of there.
I had 6 guns and a job to do. I had no choice.
And where is the enemy now? Still blocked? Or did they muscle through on their way to the lowlands?
No, they are driving back to the base. They turned around, and we couldn't hold to them. We knocked over trees in the road, the Hrum chief continued. Then, when they approached, we shot at them and tried to block their escape. But they seemed to understand this. I don't know how, but they guessed our deception. We couldn't get enough trees onto the road or force the enemy to take cover in the forest. They fought their way out again.
They must have received word from the base. Tolvern had hit hard and fast, had captured the provisional base commander within 20 minutes of Carvalho's first shots, but not, it would seem, before he sent a panicked message to the assault team. The commander of the assault team had reacted coolly under fire and fought his way out before the trap could be fully sprung, and now the enemy was rushing back to recapture the base. Somehow Tolvern had to hold it, or the entire battle would be lost.
"How many enemies are we talking about?" she asked. "Couple of hundred?"
"More like 500 or 600, I would say. Plenty of lorries and heavy weapons. Now you see why we couldn't hold them."
Her mouth went dry.
"That many?"
"Did all of your forces survive?" Pez Rickon asked. "How many do you have left to resist them?"
Tolvern had already counted in her head.
"Counting both humans and Hrum, we have 16.
Chapter 24 Drake's forces and the Lord Admiral's converged on Hot Barsa within hours of each other. Captain Linzel's powerful cruiser fleet made an in-flight rendezvous with Dreadnought, while Blackbeard came in behind. Meanwhile, Rutherford had shifted Vigilant into a support role between Fort Gamma and Fort Epsilon, disguising his ship's crippled engines, while also shoring up the planetary defenses. Rutherford's frigates set up position on the flanks, and a pair of destroyers laid down mines to slow the enemy advance. Vargas's mercenary fleet arrived next, and Drake ordered her to protect Vigilant's rear from Fort Alpha, which had never been conquered and could provide nasty surprises in the upcoming battle. Drake thought they were well positioned, even against such a massive force as Malthorn's. If not for victory, then at least a bloody stalemate. If Malthorn weren't so pig-headed, he might try something other than a frontal assault, but he seemed to have no other plan than to come in hard and fast. He didn't bother to cloak himself either, just made a straight run for the planet, a single hammer blow meant to end the battle in the first encounter. It reminded Drake of the Hrum style of fighting, apply overwhelming force to a single spot and keep pounding away until you either won or were utterly vanquished. Why was Malthorn so aggressive? Probably Tolvern had a good deal to do with it. Her rebellion was spreading its tendrils through the sugar estates of Hot Barsa. Malthorn would be itching to get to the surface to burn out the slave revolt before it was too late. Drake tried to make contact with Tolvern on the surface. Whatever she was doing was working. He needed her to keep fighting until Dreadnought had been destroyed or driven off. When that was done, he'd get the away team out of there and leave the revolt to its own devices. But he couldn't reach her. Why not? Tolvern had already contacted Gamma and Vigilant on multiple occasions. Now she'd gone dark just when she should have been checking in. Last they'd heard, she was preparing to fight security forces in a major battle. Had it gone wrong? Drake didn't have long to worry. The combined Malthorn-Linzel fleet began its run to Hot Barsa. Blackbeard was a few hours behind. She rendezvoused with the final 2 cruisers of the Rebel fleet, HMS Richmond, captained by Catherine Cates, and HMS Calypso, with the steady Philip Potterman at the helm. The cruisers came with a partial task force of support craft, including a corvette, a frigate, and 3 destroyers. All in all, Drake's fleet was too powerful to ignore. Even as Dreadnought approached Hot Barsa, Linzel sheered away with several craft to protect the battleship's rear. Malthorn sent a final taunting warning. No demand for surrender this time, only a general broadcast calling on all crews to mutiny. Take back the forts, seize their ships. They'd been coerced into aiding and abetting traitors, and mercy would be provided if they turned toward their rightful king. This had no effect on the rebel forces. It caused no defections, no additional sabotage. Any hidden enemies had already shown their colors. Dreadnought pulled up short as she and Fort Gamma came in range of each other. Malthorn sheared off his remaining torpedo boat to block Vigilant, should she come in for an attack. Rutherford had concealed her weakness well. Didn't do much good, though, as she was unable to fight at this range. The battleship stood several hundred thousand miles off and heaved a massive missile barrage at the fort from a pair of Crotalus batteries. There was too much firepower to fend off with countermeasures, and explosions were soon rocking the fortress. Dexy Gibbs was back in charge, but this time fully armed. In this initial stage, however, she sat and absorbed the punishment. Only when Malthorn tried to sneak through a missile armed with an atomic weapon did defense systems scramble to put it down. They knocked it away before it could do any harm. The atomic assault had put a lie to Malthorn's promise of mercy. Breaking through, it would have killed rebels and loyalists alike. Under cover of Dreadnought's fire, two torpedo boats pulled off from Linzel's cruiser fleet and, supported by a missile frigate, made a diving run at Gamma. This forced the commander's hand. If one of those torpedo boats had another atomic warhead, the result could be disastrous. She unloaded her missile batteries and then the fort's cannons, trying to drive off the enemy craft. One of the torpedo boats took damage, and soon both were fleeing back to Dreadnought. Their mission failed. Gibbs turned Fort Gamma's weapons on Dreadnought. The battleship swatted away missiles and torpedoes like so many pesky mosquitoes. It looked like she was preparing another run with torpedo boats. Rutherford brought up a frigate and a destroyer and swung them wide to guard against this possibility. Vigilance still lingered to the rear. Meanwhile, Fort Epsilon came into view, but it couldn't join the battle against Dreadnought during the brief minutes when it was in range. Instead, it had its hands full with Fort Alpha, still controlled by loyalists. After weeks of wary truce, the two orbital platforms were now fighting each other. Rutherford sent a destroyer to aid Fort Epsilon, but otherwise kept his forces at the ready. Drake hailed Cates and Potterman. They split the viewscreen, the young, serious-faced woman Rutherford had elevated next to the craggy-faced war veteran. They were each skilled in their own way, but only a few months ago Cates had commanded a small torpedo boat, and Potterman had spent his career at the helm of a destroyer. Neither had taken a cruiser into open battle. "The only way we win is if we get Dreadnought," Drake said. "Us, Rutherford and Vargas all at once. Pin her against the forts and finish her, like a pack of lions bringing down an elephant." Cates stared back coolly. "If only the elephant wasn't guarded by her own lions."
"You mean Linzel?" Potterman said from the other side of the screen. "More like a rhino, I'd say. Tough hide, sharp horn, ready to charge at a moment's notice. Maybe we can lure him away."
"Linzel is aggressive enough," Drake agreed. "Question is, does Malthorn have him properly caged or not? The Admiral has to feel invincible with Linzel guarding his flank. Why would he let the cruiser fleet out of its pen?"
"We could try a bluff," Kate said. "I'll come in on Blackbird's starboard, take a little damage, then feign serious injury. I'll retreat as if forced to withdraw. Linzel can't resist a wounded enemy. I'll bet he comes after me. Once I've got him in the open, Richmond is more than a match for Churchill."
Not really. Churchill was the third Punisher-class cruiser, behind Blackbeard, formerly HMS Ajax, and Vigilant. Kate's own Richmond was an older Aggressor-class cruiser, slower, less maneuverable, and with weaker armaments. Kate's meant captain to captain, of course. But even here Drake had his doubts that she could outfight her opponent. So would Linzel, which made it likely that he'd take the bait, suspected trap or no.
"When he takes the bait," Potterman said, "the rest of us rush through. With Churchill out of the way, we'll knock through the rest of those ships and get at Dreadnought."
It was an entire battle dismissed with the wave of a hand. Drake had no doubt they could get through. But even with Linzel out of the way, the corvettes, destroyers, frigates, and torpedo boats would put up a hell of a fight. Still, it was the best plan he had. "We need to keep the rest of Linzel's forces between us and Dreadnought until the last minute. The battleship has plenty of firepower to hit us from port, even while she's fighting on her starboard side. We can't face those guns until the rest of the fleet is defeated. Our only hope is to use her own ships as a shield."
"Then you want me to try to lure Linzel away?" Cates asked.
"Yes, let's do it."
They ended the call. He brought up Isabel Vargas on Outlaw and explained the plan.
"How hard can you hit Dreadnought on the forecastle?"
"Not hard enough. There's more Tyrillium on that one shield than in my whole fleet. To destroy Dreadnought from the front, it's impossible."
"I don't need you to destroy her. I only need you blasting at Malthorn's bridge. I want him rattled. I need you to draw fire."
"Drawing fire shouldn't be a problem," she said dryly. "I'm sure he's got plenty to spare."
"I know what I'm asking. It will be dangerous. I'll hold you back until we're past Linzel, but once I'm through, I've got to go after Dreadnought with everything I've got. That means you too."
"What about Rutherford?" Vargas asked. "If he comes in from starboard?"
"No," he said. "Rutherford can't lead the charge. Not with one engine. Vigilant ventures out from the forts and she's dead."
"His support craft, then?"
"You think those frigates and destroyers can stand a broadside from Dreadnought's guns?" Drake asked.
"Who can? I sure as hell can't."
"Then it's a good thing you won't be facing the main cannons. Are you ready? We're 10 minutes out."
Vargas nodded. Her mechanical eye narrowed, then dilated again.
"If you're going to get us killed, let's try not to do it at Malthorn's hands, agreed?"
"That would be an especially humiliating end." Drake allowed himself a smile. "Agreed. If it comes down to it, Linzel does the killing."
Vargas grinned.
"I like you, James Drake."
She gave a mock salute.
"Off to execute my orders. Good luck."
Drake closed the channel, grateful for her support, but also thinking how much better their chances would be with her sister Katerina at the helm of Orient Tiger and her own fleet. But no commander ever went into battle with the forces he wished he had on hand. Meanwhile, Blackbeard formed the spearhead, with Richmond a few thousand miles off starboard, Calypso off port, and a destroyer above and below. His frigates lingered behind Richmond, ready to support her exit once she feigned injury. Ahead loomed Linzel's fleet, a shield to Dreadnought's sword.
"Take us in, Ensign," Drake said.
Cap nodded. She winked at Oglethorpe, then again at Smythe.
"Ready, boys? Here we go."
The subpilot's eyes now took on a glazed look as her nav chip interfaced with the nav computer. Her fingers moved over the console. The ship gave a subtle move beneath them. It represented a violent shift in movement, Drake knew, so much so that without artificial gravity, they'd be splattered against the far wall. Blackbeard hurtled straight at HMS Churchill. Drake's other two cruisers followed. The destroyers swung wide to provide fire support. Two enemy corvettes broke from the pack and pounced. They opened fire even as the rest of Linzel's fleet let loose. Drake's forces fired their first volley in response. Soon, the region of space a 500,000 miles out from Hot Barsa was filled with snaking missiles, lumbering torpedoes, and chunks of flying metal the size of small lorries. Blackbeard struck a lucky blow on one of the streaking corvettes and forced it to retire. At the same time, Cates took a hit to her helm. Richmond shrugged, maneuvered, and launched countermeasures to fight off the rest of the attack. The other corvette came after her, followed by two torpedo boats and supported by Linzel's frigates. Cates took her cruiser and veered hard from the battle. She sent a panicked distress signal over the general comm. It was a convincing display, and if Drake hadn't known better, he'd have thought her seriously wounded. Now Cates was exposed. The corvette could pursue her, harassing, while Linzel followed in his powerful cruiser. Drake's forces wouldn't be able to protect Richmond before the enemy caught her. It was the plan, though. A dangerous one, but what they needed. But Linzel didn't bite. Instead, he consolidated his forces, targeted Blackbeard, and thundered forward. Drake had been outmaneuvered. The two sides were about to collide. and he had sent one of his cruisers off the battlefield. Chapter 25. Tolvern had her small force well prepared by the time the enemy returned, with towers manned and armed, the road hastily mined, and snipers taking position in the surrounding forest. She even had an anti-tank gun, which she wielded herself. She hid in the ditch outside the base as the rumble of lorries reached her ears, and she blasted the first vehicle straight to hell. Two shots from the anti-tank gun. The second hit the fuel tank. Flames shot skyward as she hoisted the gun and raced back within the base's protective guns. And then the enemy arrived in bulk. They seized the road and targeted the guard tower. Tolvern had hastily welded on metal plating, but the shields also restricted her ability to return fire. Enemy forces launched mortars and grenades into the compound. Others came through the forest to take the road on the opposite side, driving out Tolvern's snipers and replacing them with their own. She held them off the rest of the day, but as soon as it was dark, the enemy crept up and tried to cut through the razor wire. An armored personnel carrier attacked the gates directly before Tolvern chased it off with the anti-tank gun. Somehow they survived the night. Three of Pez Rikken's rebels slipped past the enemy defenses on the second day and slightly bolstered Tolvern's force. They told her of fighting in the jungle. Pez Rikken was struggling to get her reinforcements, but he had few guns and was short on ammo. It was a terrible irony. Tolvern had all the guns and ammo she needed, but lacked the fighters to shoot them. The third day, the first of the Hrum prisoners, forced to swallow caplets at gunpoint, began to come around. The antidote worked most quickly on the more recently addicted. Brockett tested them with sugar first, then turned them over to Tolvern to arm. She was up to 25 defenders by nightfall. It wasn't enough. The constant fire had left her exhausted and rattled, and the heat, the never-ending confounded heat. The Hrum were affected too. Three of her fighters threw down their weapons and fled the base, running for the jungle, only to be cut down by enemy snipers. At first, Tolvern had cursed the deserters as cowards. Then she began to envy them. By the fourth day, she was contemplating surrender. That night, while she was climbing the staircase to take her turn in the guard tower, she glanced up to see the sky glowing. Light flashed high in the atmosphere. Moments later, more flashes, until the entire sky was lit up, as if with celestial fireworks. She knew what it meant. Captain Drake had his own fight up there. She'd tried to raise Fort Gamma or Vigilant for the past few days, but the enemy had succeeded in jamming her communication. With the fighting up above, it wasn't like they could send her armed help, but they might be able to drop a bomb from orbit, or even parachute in arms for Pez Rikken. Maybe. She couldn't reach her Hrum ally at the moment either. Carvalho rose wearily when she entered the guardroom, hands on his back and groaning as he straightened himself.
"Shouldn't you be asleep?"
"It's my turn," she said.
"There are others who can handle this gun, and the enemy is holding still at the moment."
She cupped a hand to her ear and dragged out a smile.
"Sounds like gunfire to me."
"Not on this side of the base.
Nah, get yourself some sleep."
"Oh, I mean to," he said. "Going to slump in the corner and close my eyes. Not as comfortable as a cot in the barracks, but right now it doesn't matter much where I sleep. One of those bone diggers could burrow into my skull, and it wouldn't keep me awake."
"Then what good will you do here?" she asked. "Go down to the barracks, go on."
"Nah."
He turned on the screen of his computer and wiped away the condensation. He used the screen light to get a closer look at her.
"You don't look so well yourself."
"You wouldn't expect me to, would you?"
"We are both shell-shocked. Here I will stay with you and keep you company."
He turned off the computer and settled in the corner, pulling his knees up to his chest and disappearing into the shadows. Tolvern shrugged, although she wasn't unhappy with the company. She settled in at the gun. During lulls in the fighting, a brave Hrum mechanic had swung around and welded on more blast shielding, and the gun now had a protected slit through which to fire. The night scope was on. The road outside the base was quiet. The enemy had made a movable barricade of trees, flanked by two burned-out vehicles. They could, and often did, come over the barrier and attack directly. But for now, there was no sign of movement.
Tolvan, thought you were going to sleep?
Should we give up? He asked.
How do you mean?
Take what arms we can and fight our way to the forest. We might escape.
We wouldn't.
Surrender, then.
Wouldn't they kill us anyway?
She pointed out.
Only if we lose.
What do you mean, if we lose? That's what surrender means.
If Drake loses, I mean, Carvalho said. If he wins, then the planet is ours. He can force the enemy to give up prisoners. But if he does not win, then we are trapped down here anyway.
You're missing the larger strategic picture.
Tolvern swung the gun to check for movement along the ditches. She thought she'd spotted something, but now all seemed still.
How would I miss it? We are trapped by a superior force. It is only a matter of time.
That's what you are missing, Carvalho. Time is on our side, not the enemy's. They have to get in here. We have their food and ammo. They have no resupply. And every day we hold them here, the rebellion spreads on the plantation. Every day new eaters are broken of their addiction. Tens of thousands of doses will go out, and there's nothing they can do to stop it.
And that means what? He asked.
It means if we hold out, 100,000 square miles will be lost to the enemy for good. They'll be forced to flee for the highlands. We'll join Pez Rican, feed him guns and ammo, and move on to other plantations. One after another, they'll all fall.
In a few short weeks, she'd forced the security forces to fight, and had drawn Malthorn and Dreadnought to protect the planet's vast wealth. Without the sugar of Hot Barca, how would Malthorn maintain his hold on the throne? He had nobles to buy off, a fleet to maintain, and new wars to finance. Even with the lands gained by stealing the crown, Malthorn needed this planet. She caught movement through the scope. This time Tolvern was sure. A rustle in the grass in the ditch on the right side of the road, about 100 yards from the gates.
"We've got an infiltrator," she said. "I'm going to take him out."
But not until the enemy moved. Couldn't let them know they'd been spotted while they were protected at the bottom of the ditch. She waited for the grass to move again. Carvalho came by her side. He grabbed the end of a belt of ammo to feed it in, should she shoot. There, a movement in the grass, another 20 yards closer to her position. She squeezed the trigger. The gun kicked on with an angry snarl as she let the infiltrator have it. In the darkness, the tracer bullets looked like a glowing white knife, cutting back and forth along the ditch. A light flashed, something streaked toward her. It slammed into the guard tower, and she threw herself down. The room rocked with a tremendous boom. A hand-fired missile or grenade. She was rattled but unhurt when she picked herself up again. Carvalho cursed and shook his head. Tolvern grabbed the gun again, and then the night lit up. Gunfire flashed from both sides of the road, dozens of guns targeting her position. More gunfire came from behind the burned-out lorry, moving figures, dozens of them. This wasn't an infiltrator. This was a major assault to overrun the base.
"I'm coming out," Rutherford said. "Hold your position," Drake responded. "Is that an order?"
The other captain's tone was insolent. Blackbeard rocked from a blow to stern. Linzel was hammering her hard with his cruiser and a corvette, and Potterman's cruiser was caught in the crossfire of two destroyers while torpedo boats charged him from all sides, preventing him from coming to Drake's assistance. Catherine Cates was already swinging around with Richmond, her bluff having failed, but hadn't yet returned to the battlefield.
"Manx, is the secondary battery ready yet?" Drake asked.
"Barker says 3 minutes."
Drake glanced at the console to see the enemy corvette approaching at high speed.
"I need it now."
He turned back to Rutherford, who didn't appear on the main screen, but on the captain's console.
"Yes, that's an order, damn it. You've got to keep Dreadnought off those forts."
"I'm sitting here like an idiot. Gamma has lost her main battery, and her torpedo tubes are getting pounded. I have to bring the fight to Dreadnought. I've still got one engine. Let me do something with it.
Malfhorn is turning, Drake said. Gamma can catch a breather in a few minutes.
But you won't, Rutherford said.
No, he wouldn't. Kate's fired off two long-range missiles. Her guns were warming. Potterman clawed his way free of the destroyers and knocked out two torpedo boats, but he was too harried to give Drake aid. The enemy corvette streaked past Blackbeard, but Barker had finally got the secondary cannon online. They fired all three guns and cracked the corvette a hammer blow to the upper decks as she passed. Explosions rippled along her surface. Linzel still came at him with Churchill, together with a full complement of support craft, but Drake swung around with the main guns, just as Kate's lanced in at the enemy's left flank. Drake's own support craft were maneuvering expertly into position. It was an encounter Drake now believed he would win, given enough time. This small victory didn't change the basic equation. The battle was turning against them. Drake could match Linzel blow for blow, but here came Dreadnought. The battleship lumbered out from Hot Barsa, abandoning the attack on the forts. Drake sent out a general order to the fleet. Direct all fire at Churchill. He'd meant to break Linzel before playing his last card, get past these powerful forces before taking on Dreadnought, but that wasn't going to happen in time. So he sent a message to Isabel Vargas. Now. The mercenary fleet had been lingering just out of Dreadnought's range and was already following the battleship as she pulled out of orbit. But now Vargas accelerated and moved to cut off Malthorn's flagship. It might buy Drake a few minutes. Blackbeard gave the enemy cruiser a broadside. Calypso joined Blackbeard from below, unleashing her own torpedo boats. Kate's screamed in at the helm of Richmond. Suddenly Captain Linzel, who'd been landing most of the blows to this point in the battle, found himself under concentrated fire. He let loose with his guns, and one of Drake's torpedo boats broke apart. Next, two of Linzel's torpedoes slammed into one of the rebel destroyers. The first torpedo blasted an opening for the second one, which cut right through the heart of the ship. The rebel destroyer vented a brilliant plume of plasma and rocked with explosions before breaking in two. Escape pods jettisoned. Screams for help came across the comm. But while the enemy was attacking, concentrated firepower ripped apart Churchill's armor, both above and below. Linzel rolled away in a desperate maneuver to save his craft. Drake hit Churchill again with his belly guns, and Calypso landed two more missiles. Linzel fled, crippled and chased from the battlefield, while the injured corvette and two destroyers tried to guard his retreat. Instead of giving pursuit, Drake directed fire against the other ships of Linzel's task force, now in disarray. He'd cornered a destroyer and was hammering it into submission when Dreadnought appeared. Malthorn's battleship dwarfed every other ship on the battlefield. With more armaments than an orbital fortress and nearly as invulnerable, she scattered rebel ships ahead of her. They came to take shelter behind Blackbeard. Not that Blackbeard could provide much protection. Drake braced his forces. Vargas had been pursuing in the mercenary fleet and now attacked. Outlaw led the charge, followed by several smaller schooners and frigates. The heavily armed but poorly maneuverable Pussycat swung wide and directed fire at Dreadnought's bridge from a different angle. Drake had hoped to force Dreadnought to confront this threat, but the battleship continued forward, turning on a small secondary battery and a few missiles to deal with the mercenaries. Even this was more than Vargas could handle. Cannon ripped apart two schooners, mauled a frigate, and knocked a hole in Pussycat's formidable armor. Vargas pulled back from her run, her own ship emerging unscathed, but unable to continue the attack for lack of fire support. The three rebel cruisers swung wide in end-to-end formation to attack Dreadnought with enfilading fire. When the battleship closed, they let loose with broadsides. Explosions flashed all along her surface. Dreadnought let loose with her own guns. As if to show off Dreadnought's power, and even indifference to the combined might of the rebel fleet, Malthorn didn't target any one ship, but fired cannon at a frigate, torpedoes at the three cruisers,
missiles at the destroyers and secondary batteries at everything else, showing as she did so that she could fight everyone and everywhere at once. The result was minimal damage to the three cruisers, but one of Drake's remaining destroyers was in trouble, hit by missiles and stumbling from the battlefield straight into the remaining ships of Linzel's fleet. A rebel frigate took three torpedoes. Her ordnance detonated, and when consoles cleared, there was nothing left of her. Another frigate lost her engines and drifted aimlessly. A torpedo boat flew off, venting gases, the crew preparing to eject. While Dreadnought was knocking around various enemies, the mercenaries took advantage of the loss of attention. This time Vargas seemed to catch the enemy off guard. Outlaw landed two blows right above the bridge. Pussycat landed another before Dreadnought chased them off a second time. Jane analyzed damage. 22% degradation of Dreadnought's secondary bridge shield.
"Cap, get us up there," Drake said. "Oglethorpe, I want the rest of the fleet following. That's our chance. Hit that shield with everything we've got."
But Admiral Malthorn called in two destroyers to stand a few hundred miles off his bridge as a secondary defense. His main battery was hot and ready to fire again. Another ship approached the battlefield.
"It's Vigilant, sir," Smythe called.
And so it was. Rutherford's cruiser was firing her remaining engine and pulling away from Fort Gamma's protective guns. Followed by a destroyer and a frigate, Vigilant accelerated toward the battlefield.
"Balls of steel," Cap murmured in an appreciative tone. "Bloody fool, thou."
Drake raised his old friend.
"You have your orders, Rutherford. You are to stand down and protect those forts."
"The devil take your orders."
Rutherford's tone was unusually stiff, almost afraid if that were possible. What had gotten into the man?
"You have no hope. Dreadnought will tear you apart."
"And how is your death going to help that? You are the last defense of the planet. Do what I say. Get back there at once."
"No, Drake, I will not."
Rutherford cut the link. Malthorn's battleship was taking fire from three sides now, but still calmly positioning herself. Another broadside from the enemy. Calypso took a pounding. Two of her shields suffered so much damage, it was a miracle the cannon fire hadn't blown through her entirely. One of Drake's last two destroyers fled, hunted by missiles. She launched desperate countermeasures, but two of the missiles came through. More heavy damage. Vargas was still fighting furiously, but her support vessel, Pussycat, was fleeing the battlefield, a long trail of smoke and debris pluming out her backside. Another schooner was lost. The two destroyers Malthorn had called in now turned their guns on the mercenary flagship itself, and Vargas was about to be overwhelmed. Blackbeard and her fellow cruisers fired back with everything they had. They were scoring hits all along Dreadnought's upper decks now, but nothing was getting through. The battleship seemed to be clearing her throat, readying all weapons for another, perhaps final, volley. Rutherford had almost reached Dreadnought. What possible good could he do? With one of his engines obliterated by a saboteur, he could not maneuver about the battlefield. He might get one shot. The first time Malthorn turned his weapons on Vigilant, she'd be finished. Rutherford's destroyer and frigate peeled away, shooting. Vigilant herself continued doggedly forward.
"She's not going to fire, sir," Smythe said.
"How do you mean?" Drake said.
"I mean Vigilant isn't exposing her guns. She's readied two torpedo tubes, but nothing else is online."
What could it mean? Rutherford's shields couldn't possibly hold, whether his weapon systems were exposed or not. If he was going to take such a terrible risk anyway, why not come in shooting everything he had? And then, suddenly, Drake's mouth went dry. He understood.
"Damn you, Rutherford, no!"
Chapter 26. It took only 20 minutes until Tulvern's base was on the verge of being overrun. Her meager forces were trying to hold both the front and rear entrances against an overwhelming attack, even while other enemies poured out of the forest and hacked through the razor wire. Every human and Froom in Tulvern's force was armed and shooting, but they were too thinly placed. The enemy seemed to come from everywhere. An armored vehicle pushed up the road toward a guard post. Enemies used it for cover as it blasted at the guard tower with one gun and struck the defenders of the gate with the other. Tolvern returned fire. Her machine gun was so hot it radiated heat like a pair of tongs pulled from a forge, and Brockett was going up and down the stairs with more ammo until she thought she'd burn through every last can. But she couldn't slow the enemy vehicle. It pushed forward relentlessly. And then it stopped without warning. Rebel Hroom poured out of the surrounding forest. Most of them were unarmed, not even carrying spears, but about a dozen had assault rifles. Those with guns flanked the armored car and the forces pushing up the road behind it. They unloaded their weapons. She couldn't see the effect on the enemy hiding behind the armored car, but it must have been devastating. But nothing touched the vehicle itself. Bullets pinged off the armored car, and it swung its guns over to engage this new threat. The armed Hroom were only 8 or 10 yards distant, and they fell in a row, one after the other. The armed rebels tried to retreat to the cover of the forest, but none of them made it. The last one shuddered and collapsed just as he was reaching the trees. The bulk of the Hroom, the unarmed ones, had taken advantage of the distraction to run toward the base gates. They came on in long, loping strides. The enemy turned its attention toward them. Tolvern slapped her hand against her ear so hard that it hurt. The comlink came on.
"Get that gate open!"
It opened at the same moment that the enemy concentrated firepower on the unarmed fleeing Hroom. The back rank fell, mowed down as from a scythe sweeping through grass. The rest, some 20 or 30 in all, poured through the open gates. Tolvern had doubled her strength in a single moment. A ragged cheer went up through the base. The enemy vehicle lumbered forward to force its way through the open gates, but grenades, hand cannons, and a well-placed mine checked its progress. It fell back 200 yards, where it sat smoking, as the enemy reorganized. Tolvern took advantage of the lull in the fighting. She left Carvalho and Brockett at the guard tower and raced down the stairs to greet the newcomers. One was Pezricken. He stared at her through a soot-stained face. He wore a bandage on his neck, and his left hand was heavily wrapped as well, with only the tips of his long fingers pointing out.
"You've had a rough go of it," she said.
"That would appear to be a, how do you say it, an understatement?"
Yes, she'd personally witnessed at least 30 Hroom slaughtered on the road in just the last few minutes. From the visible injuries to him and several others, this wasn't their first fight.
"How many of your force are left in the woods?" Tolvern asked.
"Perhaps 100, but others are gathering in the lowlands. Our numbers will soon be rebuilt."
"Why did you send them to the lowlands? We need them here."
"Those are new recruits. The rest are either dead or in front of you now."
Tolvern looked around. There might be 50 Hroom in the base, 100 more still in the woods, apparently fighting it out with the enemy the best they could. That meant that Pezricken had lost more than 2/3 of his entire army in the course of a few days.
"We have plenty of arms," she said. Her voice sounded hollow. "There is that."
Indeed, Hroom had already raided the armory and were handing out rifles, hand cannons, and other arms. Some of Pezricken's newcomers turned the weapons over like they'd picked up a venomous lizard from the jungle. That would be a problem. There was no time to train them. Others, however, had clearly handled firearms before, and these she sent to reinforce positions around the base. None too soon. The enemy renewed its assault moments later.
"Get Rutherford on the screen," Drake told Oglethorpe. To Cap, he said, "Bring us in."
"Dreadnought is preparing her main battery," Smythe said. "If we go in..."
"Do it!"
Even as he spoke, Dreadnought's main battery let loose a fiery blast. Blackbeard fired desperate countermeasures and performed evasive maneuvers, but it wasn't enough. Shots slammed into them. The ship shuddered, antigrav failed, and they went flying. Drake closed his eyes, waiting for the final explosion. Then the systems came back on. He fell hard to the floor. By the time he and the others were climbing shakily to their feet,
Jane was already on the comm, giving him the grim news.
Aft shield, 27%. Starboard shield, 34%.
She continued on, but the damage report became a drone. No need for specifics. Blackbeard had been savagely mauled. Engineering scrambled to put out fires. The gunnery reported cannon off their carriages and torpedoes being dumped into space to keep from detonating in their tubes. Calypso and Richmond rushed in to aid Blackbeard's retreat. Meanwhile, Vigilant kept plowing ahead, coming straight at Dreadnought. The battleship had paid it no attention, fired not a single shot at the cruiser, though the two ships were now within range. Rutherford wouldn't respond to Drake's demands that he open a link. Only moments now, and it would be too late.
"He's bloody gone over, hasn't he?"
Cap said. She sounded angry, hurt, and full of despair.
"That bastard turned on us."
She was so wrong that Drake didn't have a rebuttal. Vargas sent a desperate message to try to get Drake's attention, but he didn't have time for her either. He tried to reach his old friend one last time.
"Rutherford, for the love of God and Albion, answer me! You don't have to do this! Nigel!"
Dreadnought had been readying another devastating attack. This time, Calypso and Richmond were within range too, as well as the rest of the fleet. Captain Linzel's surviving forces formed a tight knot and made a move on the mercenary fleet. But suddenly, the enemy seemed to recognize the threat. Vigilant was aimed right at Dreadnought, but hadn't fired a shot. Rutherford's auxiliary craft moved into position, but didn't fire either. Too late, Dreadnought swung around to show its main battery. The cannon fired before they were all in position. Vigilant took a hard blow. Explosions rippled along her surface, bits of armor and entire bulkheads blowing off. Plasma drained out the engine, like blood from a severed artery. She came at the battleship on sheer momentum. Vigilant fired a pair of torpedoes at the last moment. There was no time for Dreadnought to deploy countermeasures, and they smashed into the battleship one after another. The cruiser, burning and venting gases, plowed in after it, directly into the Terillium armor damaged by the torpedoes. For a moment there was nothing, only the crippled and much smaller Vigilant crushing itself against the seemingly immovable battleship. Then a flash of light that blanked out the viewscreen. Radiation washed over Blackbeard, bringing down instruments. They were only down a moment. When they came back on, Drake saw for himself the devastating result of Rutherford's final charge. Vigilant was no more. No sign of her. Not even so much as a gutted section of the hull. In her place was a gaping hole in the side of the battleship. 100 feet wide, it cut through armor, bomb-proofs and bulkheads to reach deep into the ship's guts and expose them to the void. Explosions rippled along the surface, blasting new holes all along the battleship's upper decks. Dreadnought turned, wounded, but not yet dead. She tried to fire torpedoes to guard her escape, but they detonated on launch, causing further injury. Drake ordered his remaining forces to attack. The remaining cruisers abandoned all caution. They pursued the wounded monster firing away. Calypso and Richmond tried to disable the engines, while Blackbeard targeted the massive hole left by Rutherford's sacrifice. Vargas and her surviving support craft raked the remains of Linzel's task force to keep them from coming to Dreadnought's aid. The battleship lost one engine, then another. The final two engines couldn't build enough speed, and a single torpedo boat swooped in and knocked them out. Again and again, Drake hammered the battleship until it was a gutted wreck. Long after Linzel's forces had fled the battlefield entirely, the rebel ships pursued Dreadnought, pounding away. Still, it wouldn't break apart. At last, drifting and helpless, someone on the helm cried desperately for terms. It was Vice Admiral Thomas Lord Malthorn himself, or, as he'd styled himself since the destruction of Yorktown, King Thomas II. The battle was over, Malthorn said. The rebels had won. What terms would James Drake offer? Drake replied with his terms, unconditional surrender. Tolvern was almost disappointed when the enemy offered to surrender. With the arrival of Pez Rickon's forces, she'd gained the upper hand. It hadn't been apparent until the afternoon the following day, when they'd repelled three separate attempts to break through. But the third attack had faltered so quickly that she began to plan a breakout. Next time the enemy came, she planned to spring an ambush before they could retreat. Then a man named Captain Betts approached under a flag of truce. He delivered stunning news. The battle in space had ended a few hours earlier. Captain Drake had apparently won, and Malthorn was taken captive. Betts, an employee of the Admiral, wanted an end to the fighting on the surface, but he needed generous terms. "How generous?" Tolvern asked warily. Betts wanted to surrender to humans, not Froom. He demanded a guarantee that any security forces on Hot Barca would be allowed to surrender as combatants, that they would be free from reprisals, and that they would be safely repatriated to Albion. And if not? If not, Betts promised, they would fight on as long as possible. They might still be defeated, but they wouldn't fall into the hands of vengeful Froom. Tolvern took this offer to Pez Rickon with her recommendation. He agreed. The hope of slavery collapsing across Hot Barca was too much to deny, even if it meant forgiving bitter enemies. The terms were acceptable. She'd won a stunning victory. Jess Tolvern had somehow overthrown the slaveocracy of Hot Barca with an away team of four, several crates of sugar antidote, and hundreds of former sugar slaves, willing to die for the cause. Chapter 27 4 weeks after the battle, Drake stood in the hallway outside the prison block with his arms crossed. Tolvern, looking smart in her new captain's uniform, stood on one side, with Nib Pym and the Froom emissary on the other. Carvalho and Cap opened the door to the detention cell. Drake had warned them not to rough up or mishandle the Admiral as they brought him out, but there was plenty of rude language. Drake let it pass without comment. A month in detention hadn't altered the Admiral's arrogance. He moved stiffly into the hallway, sized up those waiting for him with a barely disguised sneer, then looked at Drake.
"What are these Froom doing in my presence?"
Malthorn spoke as if he were referring to something foul to be scraped from the heel of one's boot. He glanced at the emissary.
"This one is an eater."
"I wouldn't presume to tell General Mos Driz who to send to negotiate," Drake said.
"Negotiate? So you will capitulate to the ones who are responsible for the atomic annihilation of Yorktown?"
Drake smiled.
"You mean yourself? I should think not."
Malthorn sputtered at this, and for a moment the long weeks of isolation seemed ready to send him into an outburst. He regained control with visible effort.
"Where is my advocate?" Malthorn said.
"You have no need of an advocate at this point."
"Then there is to be no trial. What is it you want, Drake?"
"You have already been tried, and found guilty of treason."
"Outrageous! An illegality of the highest order!"
"Under subsection 14.8 of the Navy Code, we assembled a tribunal. Evidence was presented. You had an advocate appointed for you, and she determined it unnecessary to call you as witness. She was apparently worried you would harm her case."
"Who the devil is this advocate? One of your confounded pirates, no doubt."
"You were charged with levying war against the realm," Drake continued calmly, "hindering the lawful succession, and effecting the death of our lord and king. These are charges of treason. You were found guilty on all counts."
"What do you want, Drake? What are you asking of me, to agree to place you on the throne? Is that what you are after, to seize my lands and wealth?"
These questions were so ridiculous that they didn't merit an answer. Blackbeard and the fleet had only come into orbit around Albion 2 days earlier. Drake's only thought was to secure the peace as soon as possible. They were no longer a rebel fleet, but neither had their victory been unanimous. Captain Linzel was still loose in space, with his wounded cruiser and a flotilla of support vessels. While the fighting at Hot Barsa had raged, General Fitzgibbons had landed 15,000 marines on Saxony and seized control of the continent of Suffolk. He refused to surrender, although he hinted that he might retire from the battlefield with the right offer. No offer would be forthcoming. Fitzgibbons was a traitor and the servant of a tyrant. And if Drake had any worries, his refusal was fueled by the vicious attack on his family estate and how Fitzgibbons had murdered his sister Helen. They were put at ease by the reaction of others in the fleet. Catherine Cates proposed launching an atomic bombardment of Fitzgibbons and his forces. No atomic bombing. There would be time to deal with Fitzgibbons later. Albion itself was in turmoil. Several influential dukes and earls had come over to Drake's side and pledged allegiance to the Duke of West Mercia, who had finally accepted the crown. But there were at least three other claimants to the throne, all of them on the home planet. No fighting yet, but Drake wasn't about to bring Malfoyne to the surface and give someone an excuse to kidnap him as part of some plot or other. And so, he set up in orbit during the trial. General Mose Driz's emissary came, demanding that Malfoyne be charged for war crimes before the Hroom Empire would consider any deal to jointly fight Apex. That was something Drake could not agree to, but he could make other promises.
"Well?"
the Admiral demanded.
"Your insulting questions deserve no answer," Drake said. "But you are wrong. I want nothing but justice and peace for Albion. The Duke of West Mercia will be the new king. Your slaves shall be freed, and..."
"Madness!"
"And your former plantations open to free settlers, where appropriate. I am the son of a baron and an officer in His Majesty's Royal Navy. I ask for no other honor."
"So what will it be? Imprisonment in whatever passes for York Tower these days? Is that to be my fate?"
"I wouldn't need these witnesses for that," Drake said, "and certainly not the Hroom emissary, who remains wary of deception."
His mouth formed a grim line.
"Vice Admiral Thomas Lord Malfoyne, you have been sentenced to death."
Malthorn's composure vanished. The blood drained from his face, and Cap and Carvalho grabbed his arms to keep him from collapsing. Drake said,
"That sentence shall be carried out at once."
Tolvern had returned to her old spot in the commander's chair. She relished the smooth contours made especially for her body. Oglethorpe had always seemed ill at ease sitting there. Nevertheless, he'd made way for her with obvious reluctance. The fortress formerly known as William passed below the ship, its lights glittering. It had been renamed Fort Rutherford, in honor of the sacrifice of one of the Navy's bravest officers and gentlemen. A hero, really. His death, and the death of his valiant crew, had brought about Drake's final victory against the traitor and usurper. Dreadnought, a crippled hull, sat tethered to the fort. One couldn't see them from this distance, but hundreds of mechanics, engineers, and bosuns were laboring around the clock to repair the massive damage to the battleship. Drake was eager to return Dreadnought to service in their fight against Apex, but Tolvern wondered if the repairs could be completed in time. The predatory aliens had been ravaging through the border worlds, and would soon enter Albion-controlled space. Drake stood next to Tolvern, staring at the viewscreen with his hands clasped behind his back. Tolvern wondered if he was thinking of his old friend, or if he was worrying about new threats. He was back in the Royal Navy uniform, but Drake hadn't gone pirate and back without effect. She could see it every time she looked at him. Drake was more easy in his interactions with his crew, and had not replaced Cap, Carvalho, and the rest with Navy types. He even carried himself with more ease, as if he were more comfortable in his own skin, or at least no longer needed to worry what others thought of him.
"You aren't going to witness it?" Tolvern asked.
"I have no reason to do so,
Only the Hrum emissary needs to be present. Maybe so, but there were plenty of other people down there watching, including the rest of the officers from the bridge. Tolvern had wanted to go herself, but she didn't want to leave Drake alone.
"Your final victory," she prodded. "Doesn't some small part of you want to see Malthorn's expression when they push him into the airlock?"
"Gloating over a man's death has never been my style, Tolvern."
"You're a better person than I am," she said. "That bastard is responsible for so much misery. He deserves worse. He deserves to be drawn and quartered."
"He may deserve it, but I take no pleasure in his execution." She found that hard to believe. More likely it was something Drake aspired to be neutral, impassive, just and never vengeful. But could he manage? She knew he was still angry about the senseless murder of his sister, about the death of Nigel Rutherford. Drake swore to bring Fitzgibbons to the same sort of justice that Malthorn was now facing. Why wouldn't he be happy when the Lord Admiral died?
"Or perhaps it is too much of a distraction," Drake said. "One that I cannot afford."
"Sir?"
"We face a new threat. One that appears at first glance to be unbeatable. I won't obsess about Malthorn while Apex is at our throat."
He turned to look at her for the first time since they'd begun speaking.
"You should know something. I've given HMS Philistine to Jeremiah Weber."
"I see."
The demotion hurt. She'd taken her destroyer into battle once and seen it badly damaged, but surely her victory on Hot Barsa would have counted against that defeat. But perhaps Drake would allow her to take up her old position. She could serve with him on the deck of Blackbeard.
"I have not yet prepared your official orders, as the Admiralty must first confirm my choice. But I am willing to share off the record, if you'd like. Your new command, that is."
"Then I'm to be captain again?"
"Again?" He smiled. "You were never demoted, Tolvern. This is an upgrade."
"Huh? A cruiser, sir?"
Now he laughed, in a manner of speaking.
She stared, recognition dawning in her eyes.
"Wait, do you mean..."
"I am to receive my own promotion. And, as Vice Admiral, it will be expected that I take Dreadnought as my flagship."
Drake raised an eyebrow.
"That leaves my old ship in need of new command. Captain Tolvern, of Starship Blackbeard. How does that sound?" "Oh, excuse me. That would be HMS Blackbeard now. We are no longer pirates."
"Captain Tolvern of HMS Blackbeard." It almost took her breath away. If not for the pain of leaving Drake's side, the news would have surpassed her wildest dreams. Jess Tolvern, a commoner and the daughter of a steward, was to be the captain of the most powerful cruiser in the Royal Navy. But Drake was not done surprising her yet.
"I understand you had a, let us say, dalliance while on Hot Barsa."
Tolvern's face flushed.
"Who told you that?"
"Who do you think? Cap, of course. Carvalho fessed up to her, and Cap is not the best at keeping secrets. It eventually got back to me."
"I am sorry, sir. It was a moment of weakness."
Not that she regretted it. A woman was entitled to a bit of adventure, a bit of pleasure, when she was about to face death. Could even Drake deny it?
"Was she, upset?" Tolvern asked.
"Not at all. Cap was proud, I should say, that her man managed to crack such a tough nut as you. And one who, as I understand it, has been pining for another man. Me, apparently. Imagine my surprise to hear it."
Tolvern blinked, speechless. She was aghast that Drake had heard about her silly schoolgirl crush. Cap. Good thing the subpilot wasn't here, or Tolvern would wring her neck. Good heavens, how long until she could get out of here?
"You look horrified, Jess," he said. His use of her Christian name was not lost on her. "Would it ease your fears if I were to tell you that I'm seriously considering the idea?"
She found her tongue.
"You... what? The idea of what?"
I had my own dalliance, so to speak. Perhaps you have heard about it. If not, it wouldn't take much guessing to arrive at an answer. Katerina Vargas, to be frank. The experience put certain thoughts in my mind. Now Katerina is long gone, building a fleet for a secret and distant mission. But there are other options.
Please be clear.
Tolvern licked her lips. Her heart was hammering.
What are you suggesting?
We are at war. Now is not the time for grand gestures. But it has occurred to me that our rules on fraternization may be overly harsh. If the cream of Albion is to serve king and country, there should be a way for people to do so without destroying their hopes for personal happiness. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, sir. I mean, James. Yes, of course.
He opened his mouth to say something else, but at that moment, the viewscreen switched to an internal camera on Blackbeard. It showed Malthorn, alone in an airlock, knee-deep in garbage. They'd shoved him into a disposal unit, and nobody had bothered to clear it out in advance. Good, let Malthorn go out, like the rubbish that he was.
Jane, give us info on the disposal system, she said. Disposal Unit 3, at 22% of capacity by volume, 18% by weight.
Jane's tone was calm, clinical.
Rubbish venting in 22 seconds.
Tolvern couldn't resist.
Jane, initiate countdown. Broadcast it over the general channel.
Drake raised an eyebrow, but didn't countermand her order.
18 seconds, Jane said. 17. 16.
As soon as she started to speak, Malthorn turned about in the disposal unit, looking at the camera, waving his arms, and saying something that couldn't be heard. Jane was broadcasting right into the disposal unit. At 10 seconds, his gestures became frantic. At 5, he pounded on the airlock door, face red and eyes bulging as he screamed in silence. Jane continued.
4, 3, 2, 1.
The airlock opened. Malthorn and the rest of the rubbish whooshed into space. In a moment it was gone. Drake changed the viewscreen. Another orbital fortress rolled past, framed by the beautiful green and blue sphere of Albion beneath. In a wonderful coincidence, the Zealand Islands stretched into the ocean below them, with their home island of Auckland just visible through the clouds. They had come full circle, Tolvern realized. The mutiny had begun in this very spot, not so many months ago. Drake unjustly sentenced for a crime he had not committed, and Tolvern making a desperate play to free him. Now the true villain had been sentenced and executed for the crimes that had killed millions of humans and Froom alike. Drake had taken his rightful place as the admiral of the fleet. Tolvern would be captain at the helm of the ship where it had all begun. She glanced at Drake, who stood tall and proud and handsome by her side. It wasn't everything her heart desired, but it was a bloody good start.
This is the end of Rebellion of Stars and the conclusion of the Starship Blackbeard series. We hope you've enjoyed listening so far. Next, the story continues with Book 1 of the Sentinel Trilogy, The Sentinel.
Chapter 1. The light blinked red. After 4,039 days of a steady hypnotic green, occasionally but only rarely flashing yellow, the light was now a pulsing, insistent red. Red for contact. Red for danger. Red for alert. Red for war. John Lee stared at the light, blinking, unseeing at first. It was impossible.
and his brain could not at first register it. The cool voice of the computer finally confirmed what his eyes were insisting. Alien craft, unknown provenance. Repeat, alien craft, unknown provenance. Confidence, 100%.
Lee hadn't been asleep, not really, merely dozing at his viewport, staring out at the stars. There were worlds out there, warm places with cities and trees and buildings, entire civilizations, human and alien. He'd never expected to live out his days here, cut off for year after year after year. It was a life sentence with a beautiful view and several hundred willing inmates. With little to do but maintain vigil for day after bloody day, Lee could stare for hours through the viewport, listening to old Earth music and letting the view of the stars hypnotize him. He'd timed the music to bring up Mozart's Queen of the Night aria when the local star swept across the viewport like a red ruby glowing in the warm center of the system. Later, the ride of the Valkyries would come on when the wide copper face of the gas giant they called the Kettle swung into view. What music should he play now? A red light was flashing. Not classical music from before the Atomic Age, he thought. Rather something harsh, violent. Old Earth rock or heavy metal. Change was in that flashing red light. And it didn't call for Mozart, or even Wagner. The computer continued to warn him, even as the console blinked on and the first data streamed across the screen. Lee didn't try to decipher it. Instead, he hit the comlink and made a call. Engineer Lee speaking. It was his sister, Anna, and her voice was as tight as an overpressurized exit suit. You saw? Lee asked.
Yes.
No chance of a malfunction in the long-range scanners?
I'm running tests now. It could be a false alarm, but...
But we've never had one before, Lee completed. And there's no chance that it's one of ours? That they forgot to send us a subspace to tell us they're coming to relieve us from duty? Or resupply or something?
There's no way to know for sure without turning on active sounding, which we cannot and will not do. But it's hard to imagine the Imperium running such a risk. Knowing the kind of firepower we carry and that we'd blast them out of space lanes, they wouldn't risk it.
The alert had been so sudden, so unexpected, but the ramifications were sinking in, and Lee's heart was now pounding along at a good clip. 4,039 days. 11 years. Sentinel 3 was 952 million miles away from its star, in the deep, frigid cold, where it hid among the moons, dust and debris of a gas giant. Always silent. Always vigilant. That would change one day, Lee had always thought. When the men and women under his control melted down into insanity and murder, tearing the military base apart with their zeal. That day was apparently today. Yes, this called for some heavy music. What do we do now? He asked.
Nothing, of course. We can see one ship of unknown size. There might be others well cloaked. The one we see could be a trap. Can't tell from this range, its armaments, its origin, or much else. It's a billion miles away, and we're staring at it through the sun.
Where did it jump from, do you think?
One of the outer jump points. Not where we'd expect the enemy to materialize from. But that doesn't mean anything,
Anna added hastily.
The birds are masters of deception. We can't make assumptions, not yet.
Agreed. Anna turned on visual, and her face appeared on Lee's viewscreen. She was moving among banks of creaky hardware and electronics. The past 11 years had blunted his sister's once sharp features, but the old fire was in her eyes now. Anna carried her hand computer in front of her face as she moved into the bowels of fire control, talking as she moved.
Sorry for the shaky screen, she said, but it's time to change shifts, and I need to talk to you away from prying ears to keep this conversation quiet.
There's no way to keep this a secret.
You're the base commander, big brother. If you want to suppress it, it will stay hidden, just give the word. For now, I've shut down the passive scanners.
Lee was annoyed that she'd done so without his ordering at first, but he didn't address this. Instead, he said, Will the ship come within our line of fire?
Not at its present trajectory, so we'll have to make some decisions. Try to move into position or attack it long range. Use our lures?
Premature, Lee said. We have no idea what it is yet. It might not be an enemy.
It's either one of ours, or it must be destroyed.
Lee glanced back out the viewport to the endless expanse of stars, the sweep of the Milky Way. Any moment now, the rusty gold gas giant would swing into view. The kettle was their home now, hiding them within its massive gravity well and fields of debris. A cold, indifferent home it was. The same gravity well would happily swallow them. The thought that the battle station would attack and destroy whatever ship was coming through the system, without even knowing its origin, threatened to send Lee spiraling into a gravity well of his own.
I wouldn't necessarily attack, he said.
That sounds like something an opener might say.
Anna's voice held an edge, a warning.
Don't you lose your nerve, John, not now.
I'm not, I have questions, that's all.
All these years staying strong and now is when you question your loyalty?
Lee bristled.
Where the hell are you getting that? I'm not questioning my loyalty. That's not what I mean at all.
Our job is to destroy hostile life forms before they jump through to Singapore, she said. If you're going to doubt that the very first time we face an enemy, what are we doing out here anyway?
That's what I keep asking myself. Why are we here?
He knew Anna was trying to bait him into repeating an opener's argument. What if it wasn't an enemy at all? It might be some other human ship or a non-hostile alien vessel, one that might even be an ally against the birds. Or what if the war had ended long ago? Sentinel-3 could sit forever in silence until it became a tomb for its dying crew. How would they know unless they tried to communicate with newcomers? Those were the arguments of an opener. Lee had better ones.
First of all, Anna, the ship might be a derelict. It wouldn't be the first time we got riled up for nothing.
This is nothing like that incident, Anna said. We were only 3 months into our mission, we're all on edge, and didn't know if we'd been tracked by the enemy and they were about to swoop in and devour us. And the light didn't blink red, a warning only.
Which made it all the more foolish that we came out of hiding and exposed ourselves, Lee pointed out. We were ready for a fight, and all we found was a piece of pitted metal flying on pure momentum. Whoever built it had died before our ancestors mastered fire. No risk, no threat at all, but we showed our faces to attack. If Apex had been in the system, we'd be dead.
Like I said, this is nothing like that. That ship had crossed the void. This ship appeared right outside a known jump point.
It was a known jump point 3 months ago, Lee pointed out. A jump point decaying last time we scanned it. Until we know more, we can't even be sure this ship is not a Star Leviathan. We could blast it with everything we've got, and it would only make it hungrier.
Don't be an idiot. It's not a damn Star Leviathan, and you know it.
Anna snorted, openly scoffing.
Listen to yourself, a Star Leviathan, ha!
If she were anyone but his sister, he wouldn't have put up with it. If it had been 10 years ago, he wouldn't have put up with it even from her. But over the years he'd come to value her bluntness and the way she acted as a bulwark against the openers, who'd abandon everything if given a chance. Now, however, her tone made him bristle. She pressed on.
We're going to destroy that ship, and we won't lose a moment of sleep over it either.
Stand down, Anna. That's an order. She didn't respond, her face rigid, and for a moment he thought the feed had frozen. The kettle sometimes sent out radiation pulses that could temporarily disrupt communications. Then she nodded, and he realized she'd only been showing her anger with that stare.
You will also share data with engineering, he said. We won't keep this a secret.
It's a nest of traitors and defeatists down here. Every other engineer is an opener, I swear.
You will share the data, he repeated firmly. We need every man and woman ready, including openers. They're not traitors or defeatists, so I won't have that kind of talk. I won't allow that kind of factionalism on my ship. Not now. Not when it's most critical we stand together.
This time she didn't respond at all, even after a lengthy pause.
Is that clear? He said. Anna.
I heard you.
He had to give her something to show he was on her side.
If it makes you feel better, I'll temporarily reassign Ko and Huang to the power plant. I don't want them near communications.
Well, okay.
Yes, that's good. They can't be trusted.
Anna's tone was grudging, but some of the anger dissipated from her eyes.
Can I bring in Maygot?
What do you need that scooter jockey for?
Not for scooter work, obviously. We're not sending out a ship at a time like this. He can fill in for Huang. He knows the systems up here.
And he knows dirt work, too, Lee said. Maygot stays in the farms, and you know why. Anna's nostrils flared.
Fine, are we done?
Yes. She cut the call without further comment. Again, the anger. Why was she taking it out on him? He was on her side in this conflict. Between the two of them, they'd suppressed the openers for 8 years. And Jeremy Maygot. Lee didn't want the man anywhere near engineering at a time like this. Lee didn't trust Maygot any more than he trusted known openers like Ko and Huang. Ko and Huang were likely to send a secret subspace to the approaching ship out of desperation to end their long isolation, but Maygot would blow the entire base to rubble if he thought it would gain the Singapore Imperium 5 minutes of advantage in their struggle against Apex. The predatory alien race was bent on exterminating humans in the Dragon Quadrant, and that necessitated harsh measures. Data continued to scroll across the screen on the console next to the viewport, but Lee wasn't ready to study it. News would be spreading through engineering, and from there throughout the base, to the gunnery, hydroponics, waste and recycling, the power plant, the sick bay, and even sleeping quarters. Opinions, already formed, would harden. Those on the fence would choose sides. We're not ready. It was a strange thought to come to his mind as he went to his small kitchen to heat a pot of tea. He needed caffeine and lots of it. He was about to enter a sleep cycle, but there was no way he could afford to clock out for 8 hours while intrigues brewed from one side of Sentinel 3 to the other. No, he said aloud. Not remotely ready. Not to fight an enemy. And not to make a decision if it isn't an enemy. And whose fault is that? His, of course, but how could one maintain eternal vigilance? 11 long years. Drills, military discipline, and preparations had kept them busy at first. The drills continued, but the discipline had fallen apart years ago. Lee ignored sexual liaisons, factionalism, superstitions, bitter arguments, the collapse of ranks, and the abandonment of military-style salutes and addresses. Men grew beards. Both genders changed their clothing from officially sanctioned uniforms. They let their hair grow or cropped it too short. With every passing year, Lee had let something else slip, until it was all gone. Everything but base maintenance and the all-important drills. Drills, drills, and more drills. He returned to sit at the viewport, holding a mug of tea, scalding and bitter. The better not to taste its artificial flavor. Although by now, actual tea brewed from leaf would no doubt taste strange and wrong. Messages of varying urgency blinked on his console. He ignored them and took a look at scans of the strange ship. Anna was right about one thing. It wasn't a Star Leviathan. Whatever it was, possessed some cloaking, which was either rudimentary or damaged. The half-organic, half-mechanical Leviathans had no such thing. This ship had a clear plasma signature, too. And while it was possible that this could come from a Leviathan's meal, that was unlikely. And it wasn't nearly big enough, only about 150 meters long. Even a juvenile Leviathan was 1,000 meters long, counting the grasping tentacles. A ship that had just gone through a jump point left the space around it noticeably warped for up to 20 hours. This had been a key discovery in detecting and defeating Apex craft, which used an unknown technology to make short in-system leaps, rather than relying on naturally formed jump points. Was this Apex? The passive scans were unable to tell in this case, because the ship was passing too close to the star. There was also no way to tell if it had armaments, although with cloaking, it was almost certainly not a civilian craft. That meant a warship. It wobbled slightly as it moved. And the velocity was odd, 5% light speed, but not accelerating. That was too fast for a freighter, but not impressive for a military vessel. The fastest ships could manage better than 10% light speed before fuel costs
and the beginnings of relativistic effects began to take their toll. But not a freighter, that was clear enough. A freighter had been Lee's hope, a resupply mission from the Singapore system. 11 years was a long time to wait. They couldn't risk active scanning. That would give away the base's location. But even passive data began to paint a more accurate picture. Computer, compare the plasma engine signature to known Imperium vessels. There are no matches, answered the cool female voice. Not an Apex vessel, then. Lee already knew the answer to this. It was behaving nothing like an Apex craft. Negative. Could it be a Hroom vessel? The engines do not match a known Hroom profile, she said. Lee had asked this rhetorically, not expecting an answer from the computer, which usually needed more specific commands. Data is incomplete on Hroom vessels, the computer added. Contact with the Hroom Empire is limited to fringe and affiliated systems. So Lee couldn't fully discount the Hroom theory. The Hroom possessed an ancient empire of alien worlds that lay beyond the systems mapped by Imperium vessels. They were prickly, given to aggressive defense, but not hostile if left alone. The Hroom Empire had been in decline and civil war for generations, however, which made them unpredictable, and it was against a theoretical Hroom threat that the Imperium had maintained a navy before the arrival of their true enemy. Meanwhile, 500 years after the Great Migration, the population of the planet Singapore and its colonies had been growing steadily but cautiously. Eventually, it was thought, the Hroom might be a problem. Before the war with Apex, official Imperium policy had been to avoid the Hroom and their worlds. The same hands-off policy was to apply to any other alien race, as well as human colonies. There were no other humans in the Dragon Quadrant, but it was rumored that Old Earth Dutch had settled on the far edge of the Hroom Empire, and perhaps other Old Earth settlers as well. "Are any subspace messages emanating from the vessel?" he asked the computer. "Negative. Are there any secondary signatures, like small accompanying vessels?" "Negative. Evidence of weapon systems?" "I need a more specific question." "That seemed specific enough," Lee said. "Okay, how about lasers or kinetic weapons?" "Negative. Anything odd or unusual about the engines that I haven't noted yet?" "The two engines are operating at variable strength." "Why didn't you say that in the first place?" he asked. "Could it be because you're a computer and lack an imagination? Send the engine data to my personal console." It came through at once, and Lee studied the findings. One of the two plasma engines on the mysterious ship was operating at only 62% power compared to the other. Ah, so that explained the intermediate speed and the wobble. And the slipshod cloaking, now that he thought about it. This was a warship that had been damaged in battle. Or so we are meant to believe. He heard this in his sister's voice. And Anna would be right. Apex had used this sort of trick before. They were cunning, relentless predators. 11 years was nothing. Singapore might be in ruins for all he knew, its people annihilated, its colonies snuffed out one by one. But Apex would continue to hunt until they had exterminated every last human in the sector. Yet he was certain enough that it was a warship, wounded or not. That was enough for Commander Lee. A wounded warship, either alien or from some unknown human colony, was not enough to risk the integrity of Sentinel-3. Not when he weighed the possibility that it was a trick, or being dangled in front of him as bait. He'd give his orders, and they wouldn't please the openers. Maintain silence. Complete silence. No engagement. Only watch to see if the wounded spacecraft did anything suspicious. If it were pursued by whatever had damaged it. If it gave evidence of being bait. Lee was planning his speech to the crew when new information came up on the console. He didn't see it at first, as he was caught up in how to manage the factions on the station. The openers would howl, while the sentry faction would grimly line up behind their commander, ready to defend his decision to maintain silence, or to stab him in the back if he wavered.
The 50% of his crew who had no firm alliance would gyrate madly in response to the unexpected development. He had to keep them settled, had to get the crew calmed, keep things from blowing up, quite literally, if whispered threats were to be believed, until the unknown ship was gone, and they could return to familiar patterns. Openers, sentry faction, neutrals, and the endless wait. 11 years. 4,039 days. Tomorrow would mark 4,040. Lee scrolled through the data one last time before shutting down the console, and it was then that he finally saw the wavy blue line. An incoming subspace message sent by the unknown vessel. He frowned and opened it up, curious and alarmed. His heart nearly stopped. The message used Singapore Imperium protocol, and it was directed to them. The computer had already opened the subspace, but the message was gibberish, a string of confused data. It used their codes, but there was nothing else decipherable about it. Not in its current form, at least. Lee's heart kicked into his throat, thumping harder the longer he stared at it. What could it possibly mean? Whatever it meant, it changed everything. Someone knew he was here. Someone had sent him a message. Chapter 2. John Lee was a city boy who had never lived in the country nor wanted to. As a boy, he'd climbed the steep hills of Panda City and had certainly enjoyed the gardens, trees, and tropical birds that he encountered. But that wasn't why he climbed them. It was to get a view of the teeming tropical city, to look over the turquoise bay at the ships sailing into the harbor, carrying goods from the islands that speckled the waters of Singapore like a million jewels. There were birds in the trees, he remembered, and lizards on the walls of the temples, ignored by the monks chanting and burning their incense. Other small animals, rabbits, mice, tree frogs, and of course the insects that thrived in the heat, humidity, and rain, hid in walls or in the tree canopy, making their small living among the city of nearly a million people, rabbits. But Lee had given them little thought at the time. How things had changed. He'd have welcomed flies and mosquitoes. He was so desperate for something natural and wild. The farms were the closest he could get. Nothing natural about them. They weren't even as natural as the terraced rice paddy he remembered from back home. Instead, the farms were a massive hydroponic operation, with plants carried on big rotating chains to take them toward or away from the light, with water and nutrients monitored almost entirely by computer. Every tomato was without blemish or bug bite, every leaf of every potato plant monitored for stress or chemical imbalance. But the room was big and open and humid and smelled of plants and life, and it was gloriously green. The room was alive, and when he closed his eyes and drew the scent into his nostrils, he could imagine the song and chatter of birds. Lee took a deep breath, both physically and mentally, as he passed through the airlocks and into the room. He walked down the rows of plants, occasionally letting his hand drift out to gently touch the leaves as they brushed past his face. There were technicians working, repairing tubes, trimming away dead plants for recycling, and checking the air humidity. A few glanced curiously in his direction, but nobody spoke to him. 6 hours had passed since he'd discovered the message. He'd been in turmoil ever since. Too long waiting, too long staring out at the stars. Maybe he'd clear his head, walking back and forth through the farms. "I thought I'd find you here," a voice said behind him. Lee turned around to discover his sister standing behind his right shoulder. She wore her uniform faded but in good repair, and always impeccably ironed. Anna's eyes were narrowed, her gaze sharp, and the comment didn't sound friendly but penetrating. Almost an implied question. "Well, what are you going to do about it?" Jeremy Maygott stood next to her. He was in a work jumpsuit, earth brown for those working in the farms, although there was no actual earth here, and Lee knew the man would rather be flying his one-man ship, his scooter, collecting ice from the kettle's ring, or inspecting the battle station's hull. Megat was 3 inches taller than Lee, but that understated his size. Lee and his sister were both slender, whereas Megat had augmented his already large frame with weights and other exercise. It was said he spent hours every day in the gym. Lee found the man's size and posture vaguely menacing. "I know you've been calling," Lee said to his sister. "I saw all your queries. I didn't answer because I have nothing to report."
"Nothing to report, in fact?" she asked. "Or out of choice?"
"You think I'm sitting on a translated message? I'll share it when there's something to share. The message came through on Imperium protocol, but we still have no clue what it says."
"You're sure?"
"The computer is trying to break it by brute force. That'll take time. For now, it's gibberish."
"And it should stay gibberish," Megat said.
His eyes were even harder than Anna's.
"It can only be a trap, a trick, a lie."
"You closed access," Anna said. "So all I have is your word that you haven't translated it."
"Why would I keep the message secret?"
"Presumably for the same reason you closed access to me."
"I need time, a few minutes, to look it over before everyone goes crazy."
"What are you afraid of?" she asked. "That one of us will translate it first? Why should that bother you?"
"All this factionalism," Lee said. "It's as dangerous as any enemy. Whatever the message says, someone is likely to do something dumb when he reads it."
"A strong hand prevents that sort of thing, brother."
"A strong hand? Against what? Against whom? And what do you want me to do? Put people in solitary because they're excited about this ship? Because they think it might be their salvation after 11 years of constant vigilance?"
"If necessary," Anna said. "Or stronger measures if needed."
"Stronger measures? My God, what are you talking about?" Megat reached out and plucked a leaf from the potato plant growing next to his head. He dropped it to the cement floor, where it joined the withered plant material that had fallen naturally or been trimmed by workers. Lee stared, taken aback, so shocked by the gesture that for a moment he was speechless. At last he found his voice. "What the hell are you doing, Megat?"
"It was diseased."
His voice was flat, emotionless. Lee picked the leaf up and turned it over. It was large and green, and without visible blemishes.
"I don't see anything. It's not diseased." "I work here, not you. I know a diseased leaf when I see one. The potato plant will barely notice its absence. Leaving it on would have killed the whole plant."
"You didn't even look at the leaf. I saw you. You tore it off while staring straight ahead, and then you dropped it, also without looking."
Lee found himself growing irrationally angry. It was one leaf from one plant. It didn't matter, not really. But the act was so careless, so wanton in a farm where every plant, every calorie produced was counted and compared. Megat didn't look apologetic at all. He didn't even look defensive.
"It's my job to notice these things, Commander," the man said. "You can't see what I see. That's because you don't work in the farms."
"You're a scooter jockey. This isn't even your real job."
"Believe me," Megat said, as if he hadn't heard. "When you can't spot the disease, that's when it's the most insidious. That's when it threatens to metastasize and destroy the entire plant."
Lee finally understood what the man was getting at, and his anger grew.
"It's a dumb metaphor. Men and women aren't leaves. This station isn't a potato plant. That plant you damaged completes its entire life cycle in a few months, and we've got to keep going for who knows how long. Maybe the rest of our lives."
"All the more reason to be ruthless in pruning the dead and dying," Anna said.
Lee turned on his sister. "And you, are you the one spreading this factionalism? I'm no opener, I'm on your side. I agree, and have always agreed, Sentinel 3 maintains its vigil. We do not break from protocol."
"I used to believe that, John. Now I'm not so sure."
He looked between his sister and Megat. How had they found him here anyway? He was theoretically off shift. Whatever that meant for the base commander who'd been on call for better than a decade and hadn't logged his location. Hadn't even been aware that he was on his way to the farms
until he'd already taken the shuttle to the inner ring and passed the food processing plant. It had started as a walk, a way to clear his head while waiting for more information. Lee was about to ask Anna this when his comlink opened. It was the base computer. He glanced away as if looking at the potato plant, so they wouldn't catch from his expression that he was receiving a message.
"The unknown transmission has been successfully decoded," came the dispassionate voice. "It is an audio message. The voice is human."
Lee walked down the row, glancing at the plants, as if distracted by his thoughts. In reality, his heart was pounding. The other two followed. He responded sub-vocally to the computer's message. "Play the audio." What followed was a string of nonsensical sounds. The speaker was undoubtedly human, but she didn't speak one of Singapore's known dialects, or any language that sounded remotely familiar. It was a woman's voice, no tonal quality to it at all, but pleasant and melodic at the same time. He'd heard old Earth languages, not spoken, but sung in ancient recordings of operas, and assumed it must be one of those. "What language is it?" he asked, again subvocally. "Italian? German?"
"Negative. Unknown language."
Anna tapped him on the shoulder, and he turned around.
"Well?"
she demanded.
"Are you going to keep ignoring me?"
Belatedly, Lee realized she'd been talking to him as he walked. He'd been so swept along in that mysterious unknown language and his queries to the computer that his sister's voice had faded into the background, along with the hum of the air purifiers and the bubbling of water in the hydroponic system. Whatever she'd been saying, he had no time for it. "I have nothing more to discuss," he said. "Return to your posts and await my orders." Lee waited impatiently as Dong Swetnam listened to the audio for what had to be the 100th time. The man wore headphones, had the sound turned up loud, the audio slowed. He held his hand computer, which he used to make notes or scroll through what appeared to be a dictionary. Whenever Lee tried to interrupt him or peer over his shoulder at the notes he was taking, Swetnam waved him off with an impatient air. Swetnam was possibly the most unusual last name on Sentinel-3. Singapore had been settled by colonists from a small city-state during the Great Migration half a millennium ago, and almost all of the surnames were Chinese or Malay in origin. Swetnam claimed he was descended from a British governor of the old Earth version of Singapore. People teased him about it. He certainly didn't look different from anyone else, but having such an ancestor, mythical or not, had made him a student of old European languages. Swetnam claimed to speak two different forms of English, plus German, a little Spanish, and a smattering of French. Not that there was anyone around to test his knowledge. For all Lee knew, he was making it up and mumbling nonsense. At last, Swetnam peeled off his headphones.
"Yep, it sure is."
"Sure is what?"
"An unknown dialect of Old Earth English."
"You told me that already," Lee said. "You said it 5 seconds in. That was, what, 2 hours ago?"
Swetnam glanced at his screen.
78 minutes. I'm telling you, it's English. You wanted confirmation, and I'm giving it to you. Definitely English."
Lee gritted his teeth.
"That's not confirmation. That's a reassertion of a statement without confirming facts."
Swetnam blinked, looking chastened by the heat in his commander's voice. "Good." Lee had been standing in the man's tiny quarters all this time, while Swetnam listened and listened, and this is what he got for his efforts. Swetnam was a low-level engineer who didn't merit either a kitchen or a private bathroom. He owned a single piece of furniture that converted from a chair to a bed and had minimal storage underneath it. Every inch of wall in the room was covered by scribblings in some Roman-style script, or with pictures of unknown Old Earth figures, most of them with long faces, wide eyes, and big noses. Romans? Americans? Lee didn't know enough about that sort of thing to differentiate.
"So there's nothing else you can give me?"
Lee pressed as Swetnam listened to the audio yet again.
"I didn't say that, sir. I was only confirming that it's English."
"Damn it, will you get to the point? I need to decipher this message, and I'm running out of time to do it."
In the 10 hours since the unknown vessel was detected, it had swung around the sun and changed course. It would approach Sentinel-3 much closer and much sooner than had initially been supposed. Discussion was heating up throughout the base, and would practically explode once word got out about the intercepted transmission.
"I can definitely help you decipher it," Swetnam said. "I picked out a proper name, which will help the computer parse the audio. I have also identified 3 words and possibly 5 others.
"That's all," Lee said. "There's 137 seconds of audio. It goes on and on. Sounds like one babbled, nonsensical phrase. What can 3 words and a few guesses help us?"
"It will help us plenty. Narrowing it to English allows the computer to run it against a database of known words, especially once it can identify sound shifts. It's not a trivial operation. Human language has always been hard for computers to master, but I could theoretically program rudimentary translation software, grasp the meanings to enough words, and we can construct a small lexicon and build on it."
"You can do all of that? I thought you were a mechanical engineer. What is your engineering rank, a 9?
Swetnam met his gaze. "I'm only a 9 as an engineer. In communications I was a level 1. Head of communications, in fact."
"Were you?"
"I'm not surprised you don't remember. Comm is mothballed, and we never had much respect in the first place."
That explained a few things. There was no need for comm, because Sentinel-3 was silent. Everything to do with external communication had been automated by the computer, even long-range scans, and communications personnel reassigned. Swetnam had apparently been someone important in his previous iteration.
"How long do you need?" Lee asked. 10 hours? Maybe less."
"Really?" Lee said, surprised and impressed.
"Sure, I'll grab a few others, pick up a couple of programmers to help. I assume you'll give me whatever computer resources I need. A good team and adequate computation time will move it along quickly. The first one I want is Hillary Coe. She's brilliant. She can head the software efforts."
"No, no, you can't do any of that. I need this kept quiet."
Swetnam pushed up his glasses and studied Lee's face.
"We can't keep this quiet."
"We can, and we will."
"Commander, no, this is too important to suppress."
"How do you mean?"
The man's eyes bugged.
"It's our salvation. You've got to see what this means."
Ah, so that's what he was. If there had been a warning light on Swetnam's face, it would now be flashing red.
"How exactly do you see this as saving us?" Lee asked.
"Isn't it obvious? There's a human ship coming right at us. They've got Imperium codes and are urgently trying to send us a message."
"You know who else might have Imperium codes?" Lee said. "Apex."
Swetnam talked on as if he hadn't heard.
"We've been found by another human colony, some other descendants from the Great Migration, someone from what they used to call the Anglosphere. They must have whole fleets, a planet of their own, maybe multiple planets."
Even if all of this were true, 500 years had passed since humans set out for the stars. The history of Earth itself was so bloodstained that there was no reason to believe that another human civilization would be friendly. But there was something that concerned Lee more.
"How did the ship get the Imperium communication protocols?" he asked.
"What?"
"The message came through with our protocols. That's how we were able to read it. Some other human population surely has a radically different way of communicating, right? They wouldn't use the same string of data to indicate that it was an incoming message. That would be impossible."
"They must have had contact with the Imperium," Swetnam said, his voice even more tight and excited.
"They must already be our allies."
"You are an opener and naive," Lee said. "This is exactly the sort of tactic Apex used to trap us in the first place. The mining ship, the distress call, that's how the war started. Or have you forgotten all of that because you're so eager to talk to someone?"
The initial Apex attack had nearly killed Lee. He'd been commanding a light carrier patrolling the outer region of the Dragon Quadrant when he'd received a distress call. A mining ship was under attack by an unknown craft, probably pirates. 2 war junks had already moved to intercept and would no doubt have the firepower to chase off the raiders, but Lee was ordered to follow up.
He arrived to find the war junks defeated, and several long, needle-shaped craft picking apart the carcasses. It was later determined that the mining ship had been captured and had sent out a fake distress signal to see who would respond. The enemy ships attacked Lee's light carrier. He sent out his three strikers, sacrificing them, while he fled for the jump point. That was Singapore's first encounter with Apex, an alien race of bipedal bird-like creatures that destroyed everything it touched, that took prisoners only so that it could eat them. They had special ships for the purpose, giant harvesters, for the ritual torture and consumption of sentient life. But in the brutal first phase of the struggle, the Imperium had learned what tactics and weapons could fight the birds. Most important was silence and stealth. Apex could break any communications, but had a hard time finding a heavily cloaked ship. Stay quiet, stay hidden, and you could evade them almost indefinitely. Thus the Sentinel battle stations. Swetnam was still staring at Lee, his face eager, his eyes blinking rapidly behind his glasses. 11 years may have erased the man's memory of the brutal war, the millions lost, 2 entire colony worlds destroyed. But Lee remembered.
"Please don't tell me you're going to suppress this message," Swetnam said. "I know what the Sentry faction believes, and I know what those people will do. They'll destroy this ship before we have a chance to talk to them."
"You're not listening to me. It's probably a trap."
"But what if it's not? Commander, listen to me. Please, before you kill them all..."
"Calm down, Swetnam. I never said I was going to attack the ship. I only need to keep this information quiet, at least until the message is translated."
"Give me Hillary Ko, then. I need her. I can't do it on my own."
Lee didn't know Ko very well, but doubted she'd cause trouble. If Ko was an opener, she wasn't a rabid one. And if she harbored sympathies for the Sentry faction instead, she kept them equally to herself. There was one question above all that concerned him. "Can Hillary Ko be discreet?" he asked.
"Of course. And when it's translated, what then?"
Lee turned the question over. He was torn in two directions. When he'd been talking to his sister and Megat, he'd been repelled by their hard-line position, by the knowledge that they would kill to keep Sentinel-3 silent and isolated. There was a broken, burned-out docking bay, where they and their companions in the Sentry faction had proven that. The first outbreak of factionalism on the ship had occurred only 4 years into their long vigil. An opener, they weren't called by that name in those days, had rigged a scooter with a subspace transmitter, then hacked into the communications array to send the actual message. Convinced the war was over, that Singapore had won, and the battle station was somehow overlooked, the man had planned to run the single-man ship out behind the nearest of the Kettle's moons and send a subspace to the home planet, giving away their location, of course. Anna had caught wind of the plot, rushed to intercept the rogue pilot before he could escape, and blasted him before he could launch. Lee had authorized the operation, and had always wondered if he'd done the right thing. They'd killed a man and damaged part of the station. Could he do the same thing now? Hard to say. Swetnam and his sort posed a risk not unlike that of the rogue scooter pilot all those years ago. The risk of remaining on mission was a long, lonely death. They would eventually die of old age, and the last few survivors would probably starve to death, too old and feeble to grow their own food, if the oxygen plant didn't fail and suffocate them all instead. Sentinel-3 would eventually become another derelict, a floating coffin in orbit around a distant forgotten gas giant. But the risk of communicating with the outside world was more immediate and obvious, brutal and short. Apex might kill the low-level functionaries like Dong Swetnam quickly enough, but a different fate awaited the officers. If captured, Lee would be tortured, then eaten. The Apex Queen would peck out his eyeballs, his tongue, his ears, his nose.
then she and her princesses would plunge their beaks into his belly and tear out his intestines. He would be alive when they did it. Chapter 3 Ak-Eek ruffled her feathers and spread her wings to display her red underplumage. Recognizing the dominance and fertility of a queen commander, the two sentries turned their beaks to show acquiescence and folded their tattered wings inward to show submission. Feathers littered the hallway at their clawed feet. These two were drones, permitted a bit of color as sub-lieutenants of a princess commander, but such was their mistress's disgrace that their feathers were uniformly gray and brown and had begun to fall off. Bare flesh showed on their necks, and bloody scratches marked where they'd been tearing at themselves. Lack of control turned drones neurotic, and they'd eventually kill themselves. Upon entry to the ship, Ak-Eek had found similar levels of distress even among the higher-ranked drones, the taller and more aggressive ones that would have attacked her mercilessly under other circumstances for daring to enter without permission. Instead, the drones had showed their necks and exposed their breasts, quivering with fear, but prepared to die should she take their lives. Ak-Eek ignored them and strolled inside, unaccompanied by any drones or soldiers of her own. She expected no opposition and had yet to receive any. Ak-Eek gestured with her beak.
"Open this door."
"We cannot, Queen Commander," one of them answered. "It is voice-locked by our mistress." Ak-Eek let out a terrible cry and flew at the one who'd spoken. She grabbed the drone in one talon and hurled it against the wall. There was a loud crack, and the drone lay there, shuddering, squawking in pain. Ak-Eek swooped over and stood above the drone with her hooked beak at its throat. The squawking ceased, and the drone merely shuddered. The queen turned to the other.
"Get your mistress, now."
To Ak-Eek's surprise, Sul M walked proudly down the hallway, her head bobbing with all the arrogance of a queen commander, not a princess who had just been tricked and defeated by an alien race. Said aliens now racing off with valuable intelligence as to Apex technology and tactics. Three more drones flanked the princess, her guards. Her plumage was still bright green, and to Ak-Eek's surprise and rage, she boasted red feathers on her breast. Sul M still carried the scent of high rank about her. Must have continued to secrete her dominant saliva to keep her drones in line, but it didn't seem to be having the desired effect on her underlings. The drones surrounding her shivered and keened in terror. They'd smelled and seen Ak-Eek and knew what the Queen Commander was about, even if their mistress did not. How could Sul M be so blind as to her imminent demise?
"This door is voice-locked,"
Ak-Eek said, her voice warbled with rage. The drones cringed at her high pitch. The one she'd cast down remained motionless, only its moving eyes showing it was even still alive.
"Yes, it is," Sul M said. "Open it at once. I know what you're going to do, and I forbid it. You have no right to demand entry. Open this door at once, or I will tear open your breast and feed on your heart."
Sul M opened her beak, seeming on the verge of defiance. A bird of her stature in the flock wouldn't have risen so high without aggression and stubbornness, without pecking her way through rivals, literally in some cases, and wouldn't take her demotion easily. But her drones weren't so confident, the brilliance of their mistress's plumage and the smell of her scent glands notwithstanding. Sul M looked around her, seemed to recognize her precarious position, and fluttered her wings. It was an arrogant gesture, but a final one. She cocked her head and squawked for the door to open. It obeyed her voice command. The two commanders fluttered their way into the nesting chamber, Ak-Eek leading. Some of the drones started to follow, but the queen called for them to remain in the ship corridor. They didn't even glance at the princess to see if the order would be countermanded, but retreated with a series of pitiful squawks. The chamber was warm and humid.
Dim red lights gave off heat from above, like a collection of tiny suns. The apex flocks had manipulated their genes hundreds of times, in ways both small and large, creating numerous castes and ranks. But some things could not be altered. Eggs only hatched under conditions like those found in the swampy tropical lowlands of the homeworld. There were at least 200 eggs in the chamber, smooth and gray. The fresher ones lay bunched together, while the ones closest to hatching had been moved to one side, so that the new chicks wouldn't peck apart their rivals as they emerged. Ak-Eek walked across them, letting her talons crush the eggs as she put her weight down. By the time she got to the other side of the chamber, a trail of yolk and shell and squirming, dying chicks lay across the floor. The smell of them was ripe and delicious, and Ak-Eek paused to gobble down a few of the larger chicks that had been on the verge of hatching. They squirmed and squeaked in delicious terror as they went down. The Queen Commander carefully watched Sul-Em when she came up. The princess and mother of these eggs gave no reaction, except for a nervously darting tongue passing in and out of her beak. Inside she must be screaming with rage, but she showed nothing. "Your drones are forfeit," Ak-Eek said. "By rights, I could eat them all, and perhaps I will. I may pluck out your royal feathers and reduce you further." "I understand your rage, Queen Commander. Mistakes were made." Well, this was perhaps not going to be as hard as Ak-Eek had thought. She had been prepared to use her saliva, and the dominance of a queen would have forced even a princess to acquiesce. A lesser bird could not take the queen's saliva without it bending her will to her mistress's.
"Mistakes!" Ak-Eek gave a derisive caw. "You lost 3 lances and let the primary warship escape. And through a trick, a subterfuge, deception is our provenance, our strength. And you behaved as foolishly as a hroom." "You are mostly correct, Queen Commander."
Ak-Eek's head feathers ruffled in surprise.
"Mostly. Yes, mostly."
Ak-Eek screeched angrily. She stomped across the room, crushing more eggs and gulping down the chicks that came gushing out. She would reduce this cursed brood until there were only a few dozen of the gray, stone-like eggs left, then go back and pluck Sul-Em's princess feathers. Finally, a dark warning about killing every last chick and drone in Sul-Em's flock of ships. 10,000 drones would be destroyed if Sul-Em persisted in her defiance. It would serve as a warning to the other princess commanders in the flock.